What I want to do today is quickly finish up the sublime and move on to the question of Kant on art, which I'm kind of looking forward to doing since I've been up since 5 o'clock this morning trying to figure it out. So at the end of last time, I offered a kind of vitalist return to nature vindication of why the sublime was the occasion for refining ourselves as parts of the natural world, of reminding ourselves of our vitality. And I take it, I don't have a chance to really work it out in detail here, but behind my thinking on that issue is the thought that we started out with at the very beginning of the semester, namely nature as the return of the repressed, that is, living nature as what has gotten repressed in the course of the civilizing work of morality, of the production of society, and at a certain moment we want a different conception of nature to re-arise, one that reminds us of our own bodily belonging to nature and our own standing as living as well as rational beings. The other way of thinking about the sublime, I think of that as the notion of what's meant by the promise of happiness. That is, Kant, as you know, just to say this is not arbitrary, Kant's notion of the highest good is of happiness rewarded in proportion to virtue. So Kant realizes that it's somewhere along the end of the story, it's not just good enough that we're virtuous and good and rational and self-determining. We'd like to feel good, too. And the problem is, and this is really what part of the second half of the Critique of Judgment is about, the civilizing process is a work of discipline, including self-discipline, the disciplining of society, the disciplining of nature, the mastering of ourselves, the mastering of nature, all this mastering are forces of domination, so that the conditions of civilized life are the repression and the domination of nature and desire, and that in the aesthetic we always find, or we are finding, I'm claiming, a reemergence of that, and I'm claiming the sublime is one of those places in which the relationship between culture and nature is reignited. That is, we find again that belonging. Of course, I won't go through it here, but you know, this is a continual element within culture, and I would argue that it's what connects art to sexuality. That is, I think our interest in sexuality is beyond hormones, an actual interest in the notion of happiness, of the transfiguration or realization of bodily happiness, and that sexuality is always a symbol of that. It seems like all that our own sexual lives can themselves be symbols of something, but I take it that they are. And I take it that it's not an accident that art and sexuality are intertwined in the way they are. The flip side of the sublime is what I want to here talk about. If you're interested in that topic, I beat that idea to death in the end of my book, Against Voluptuous Bodies, talking about Cindy Sherman. That's really my interest in her work. The flip side of the sublime, or let's say the skeptical aspect of the sublime, concerns the way in which it functions as a reassurance of ourselves as not parts of nature. So that's the sublime is a systematically, I think, equivocal sight. It both testifies to and is a moment in which we reconnect with the claims of vitality by recognizing our natural being. Conversely, especially as Kant plays it out, it's a continual work, I'll argue, of reassurance of our not belonging to nature. It's a continual work of repetition to reassure ourselves that we are not natural and that we are something else. And the way to hear this, I think, most forcefully is to hear the way in which Kant describes the sublime, not in the third critique, but in the anthropology from a pragmatic point of view, where the scene of the sublime is given a dramatic and narrative form, or so I want to argue. Here's the passage. The sublime is that greatness in size or intensity which inspires awe. It simultaneously invites us to approach it. It's that sentence that always gets me. It simultaneously invites us to approach it. What kind of invitation is this? Invited to approach it so as to make our forces equal to it, he then comments in parentheses and then carries on, and deters us by the fear that in comparison with it we shall shrink into insignificance in our own estimation. Thunder over our head, for example, or a high, rugged mountain. When we are in a safe place, the gathering of our forces to grasp the appearance, along with our anxiety about not being able to rise to its greatness, arouses astonishment, a feeling that is agreeable because it continuously triumphs over pain. So the sublime is not an object for taste. It is rather the feeling of being stirred that has the sublime for its object. But when an artist exhibits the sublime to us by describing it, or clothing it in ornaments, per erga, extra work, it can and should be beautiful, since otherwise it is wild, coarse, and repulsive, and so contrary to taste. And that per erga is where Derrida goes crazy about Kant on the sublime. The paragon of the sublime is beautiful art in this setting. Beautiful art is the clothing or framing of the monstrous. Greatness that is contrary to end. But this makes the sublime itself stand in a curious relation to Kant's aesthetic. Both a moment of it, formally analogous with the logic of beauty, and outside it, a function of a logic that belongs more to morality than aesthetics. And this is what kind of piques my curiosity here. My suspicion is that the sublime, too, is some kind of paragon, some kind of extra work some kind of clothing for another scene, right? So the argument is, right, that beauty is a paragon for the sublime. And I'm suggesting the sublime is a paragon for X. Yeah?
How much of this is like a relation between natural purposiveness versus art?
Well, the sublime is the moment of non-purposefulness.
So is it like the intermediary between? Do you see what I'm trying? Because the thing is, natural purposiveness is like in itself, like what it is. And then art is considered to be man-made. You know, so basically the purposiveness of nature is not the same thing as man-made art. So I was wondering...
Right.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about that when we get to art.
Well, I'll be quiet now.
Okay. But no. So but art is art beauty. So this is beauty... art beauty, he's talking about here, is the way we clothe the sublime, right? By think of you know, Beethoven symphonies and romantic paintings and all of that. You know, that gives us both the image of the sublime, but it's not monstrous or coarse. It is clothed in an acceptable way. Now, by framing it. And I'm saying the sublime, too, is perhaps a frame for something else. And it's that something else I want to kind of understand. What kind of scene the sublime is a scene of, which is to say, why do we seek it out? That was the question we asked it the last time, right? And this is the question we're still trying to answer. Why do we put ourselves through this form of pain pleasure? Well, the safe place is a condition for what unfolds being a drama. That is, the safe place is... So the sublime is made possible, right, again, by a safe place. And the safe place is what turns what would have been some natural event of some kind into something else, some sort of drama. So the safe place is the operation of an aestheticization. And again, I want to ask, aestheticization of what? So the sublime is not a source of fear, but it's a representation or dramatization of fear, and is the spectator him or herself who frames the threat and who is also, as I suggested last time, an actor in the drama, that we are both the authors and protagonists of this story. Now, in order to feel the fear adequately and the threat sufficiently, we must put ourselves into some proximity to the sublime object. It must already have come on the scene. It must have invited us, or we must have felt ourselves invited. Without the invitation, without the lure, without the objects, without the desire for it, the object could not interrupt our narcissistic self-complacence, which is, of course, what we're interested in. We want to be torn from our narcissism. We want to feel, let's call it the touch of the other. There is then a test of forces, and what is tested thereby is what our forces are, which is to say what is tested is who we are, our being. So the testing must raise us to an insight into the very nature of what our forces could be, what our nature is as living human beings, and do so in a way that is emphatic, that is, makes it clear that, when I say emphatic, makes it clear that we can have confidence that it is indeed what our essential forces are that are being hit upon in this experience. That is, so one of the things that attracts us to the sublime is it reveals to us both what our natural forces are, who we are as mortal beings, and what our extra-natural forces are, what we are as supranational natural beings. And the so that the sublime is a paradigm limit situation, which in being a limit situation attracts us precisely because of its apparent revelatory power. So we are threatened and fearful. And what threatens our sense of our bodily integrity. It awakens in us an awareness of our sensible being, and furthermore, it awakens in us an awareness of our sensible being as an indeterminate but absolute vulnerability. We are injurability, which is to say we are aware of our mortality as sensible beings. Hence, we are threatened to the limit of our sensibility. So in the test, at the very least, our mortal being is revealed as mortal. We're scared to death. But safely, in a safe place. It's a drama, after all. Now, and this is the story we're familiar with, in this test, we also learn that we cannot be confined to our mortal being, to our life, and to our drive for self-preservation. Hence, our vulnerability is both accepted, acknowledged, and repudiated. And the repudiation will be ambiguous, I think, between a justified denial. After all, in some sense, we are always in excess of our merely sensible being, and a complete self-denial or a self-repudiation. After all, what the story of the sublime wants to say is that we essentially are not sensible beings, that we are essentially self-legislating, autonomous creatures who project ourselves onto the screen of the sensible, but are always beyond it. So, attraction and repulsion of the same object. Phrases Derrida's. So attraction and repulsion of the same object. the safe place can now be recognized, because the safe place is not merely a physical distance, it's the place of reason itself, whose transcendence beyond all sensible threat is assumed from the outset. Hence the apparent transition from imagination to reason is made through the determination of reason. Now this for me is the puzzle. That's structurally seems obvious. Yeah? That is, reason is setting up this situation in order to test itself. So reason projects the other as the limit of its power, right? As a limit of the sensible, for the sake of reaffirming its own powers of transcendence. The sublime, we are told over and over again, halts the easy play of beauty and introduces an abrupt seriousness. Here, the imagination, the seriousness, of course, is the seriousness of the idea of a mortal threat, and the idea of that threat being overcome, sublated, defeated. Here, the imagination not only includes our sensible constitution generally, but stands for, and I think assumes, that is, remember, it's the imagination is what finds itself unable to, in its own terms, transcend this force. The imagination breaks open, is defeated. The imagination, I think, almost everywhere in Kant, is a stand-in for the body. Indeed, if I had a hermeneutical key to read, I mean, one of the great questions is, how is Kant different from Descartes? Why is he different from Descartes? And the answer would be that something about Kant does not exclude or have the kind of mind-body dualism that Descartes has. And that's because the notion of mentality in Kant is always mediated by the imagination. But I want to say that mediation by the imagination is always the acknowledgement of bodily mediation. So the imagination is always the placeholder for the body, and is in a way the measure and access of the body. Hence it is unsurprising when Kant says that the primary subjective, sensory, immediate, living measure proceeds from the body, things come to a relationship of body to body. The measure of the body is paragraph 26. So the contest of the sublime is really a contest or a struggle between two bodies, each exceeding itself, each being more than body, and in that excess, threatening the other body. Well, I'm laying this out.
What I don't get is that Kant doesn't really accept an identity in difference the way Hegel does. So if you're talking about this continuous process, there's no, it stays that way forever. And the thing is, if it stops, then does that mean that it's still going to be one-sided? Or, is Kant's attempt at not having it be one-sided the reason why he's saying that it's a continual process of always mediating itself?
Great. Great question.
Okay.
The question is not merely
what is the sublime? But why do we seek it again and again? That is the right question. And that's the one I want to answer here.
Well, I'm trying to narrate the sublime, maybe not too discreetly. I'm trying to narrate the sublime in a way that sounds, or should sound, an awful lot like Hegel's dialectic of master and slave. That's what I've been doing. And I've been doing that because I take it that we assume ourselves to be self-conscious beings and desire to have validated and confirmed the sense of ourselves as transcending our natural determination. Only a completely circular confirmation would arise from Kant's uninterpreted account of the confrontation. Real confirmation can come only from another self-conscious being, a being who would also be sensible. And this is why, I think, Kant often says of the sublime that it is a schema for ideas, ideas of reason. That is, only if nature has ascribed to it the infinity of reason can its threat be sufficient for its overcoming to signify our transcendence of natural determination. So the battle is of body to body, but of bodies in excess of themselves. And the issue is a mastery of nature within and without. And in the experience of that mastery is our pleasure. So this is an experience of pleasure in domination. The pleasure of dominating our fear, if not its object, of finding ourselves more than what threatened from the measure of the body, is what reassures us of our place in the world. So I take it that the sublime is a repetition of what I take to be the founding moment of every modern philosophy, namely the coming to self-consciousness out of a scenario of violence. In Descartes, it's the violence of the evil demon. In Hobbes, it's the state of nature and the war of all against all. In Hegel, of course, it will be the master-slave. In Kant, I'm suggesting it's the scene of the sublime. That it's the scene of the sublime, which is the occasion for an assertion of our rational self-possession. And I take it that it matters that this occasion for an assertion of our rational self-possession happens in Kant aesthetically. So what is given in the sublime is the demand for the overcoming of nature and the assertion of originary subjectivity. That subjectivity becomes self-consciousness
becomes the I think only by the overcoming of the absolute other. And it does throw through a kind of imaginary violence. So the violence of the sublime is both the threat and its overcoming. So in the sublime, nature comes to appear as powerful only when its power has been negated. Only when it is no longer powerful. Only aesthetically. Nature is empowered by reason only imaginatively. Tom Hoon, in a lovely essay in the Journal of Aesthetics in 1995, called The Kantian Sublime and Nostalgia of Violence, Nostalgia for Violence, makes the claim this way. He says, the pleasure of the sublime is what binds subjectivity to itself. That is, I reassure myself and I become a subject in that pleasurable overcoming of that threat that I triumph over. So it is a moment when subjectivity feels itself, the moment when subjectivity becomes whole and cohesive.
I mean, there's two ways to take this. Mm-hmm. Genetically and as a phenomenology. So the subject can reveal to itself what it is, and in revealing to itself what it is, it overcomes its fear.
Right.
And that is a certain pleasure. But it can also be a sort of, which you seem to suggest, a real genetic claim that this is the mechanism by which subjects come.
Ruby's point is the key one here.
What did I do?
You asked the right question. The question is, the reason why the two are not separate is the repetition. It's the question is, why do we do this again and again? And my answer is that for us modern subjects, it is genetic. That is, I don't know about the origins of subjectivity. I'm saying that at the origins of modern subjectivity, we continually, as it were, repeat this moment, and we have to, as it were, repeat the moments of violence and domination and take a pleasure in that as a condition for reassuring ourselves that we are rational. So the claim is that rationality rests upon this pleasure in violent domination that is rehearsed again and again. Yeah.
So the thing is, if you take that as its basis, it's like it never overcomes itself. So when you keep doing that, it's like
it's appalling, I agree.
No.
That's the kind I'm trying to make. I'm trying to make the point that the sublime is this continual repetition of ad infinity, an illusory notion of self-cohesion.
Right, but the thing is, it never resolves itself.
That's right.
So the thing is, if it did resolve itself, you see how it would be one-sided, because he's talking about like the aesthetic part of it.
It cannot resolve itself.
Right.
That's the argument I'm making.
Oh.
I'm making that this is, that its aesthetic character, so I'm claiming that there's an aesthetic condition of modern rational subjectivity. To put it another way, that modern rational subjectivity rests on a certain fantasy. And that fantasy is a source of pleasure, a pleasure in violence, and that pleasure in violence is a condition of the cohesiveness of the rational subject. That's the argument I'm making. So I tried last week to present a good sublime, and this is the ultimately nasty sublime, right? And I think they're both there in Kant. Right? Yeah?
Just a much more banal question. I've kind of lost where nature is now. I mean, so we have this idea of overcoming fear, but how is it not just overcoming fear? What about if somebody hands me the bucket of grapes, but it's at you, they tell you that it's eyeballs, and you have to put your hand in, and you're terrible. But surely that's not the sublime. Or is it? Or going into a haunted house, or, you know, overcoming other kinds of tarantulas, or whatever. I mean, is that the sublime as well, then? That seems
It will be the sublime if it is continually sought out as a form of imaginary testing of your worthiness to have a standing in the world überhaupt.
So fear factor, then, would be a pop cultural...
Absolutely.
Or Saw 3.
Hmm? Saw 3, sure.
It just seems like a very far gap between heaving oceans, that's all.
There is a far gap. I am arguing that there is a... Remember, the heaving ocean is seen at a distance from the shore. So that I'm suggesting that there's a pattern within these. And you know, that I talk about in terms of Cindy Sherman. Cindy Sherman's art actually derives from realist horror movies. And she actually made a realist horror movie, which is, what's it called, The Secretary, is that? Pretty gruesome. Yeah.
If we read this in a kind of as a kind of play about the state of nature, does this imply from your point that any kind of modern regime grounded upon this principle be a regime of domination?
It is a claim that it is certainly the Hegelian claim that a rationality that is self-reassuring rather than being reassured in a relationship to another will tendentially slip into domination necessarily, because it's built on, right, the domination of the other. I mean, that is its structure. So it only knows the other as what is to be dominated, what is to be overcome. That's its relationship to nature. Which is why I'm saying the sublime is an antagonistic moment in Kant's third critique. One wishes it wasn't there, since it antagonizes, I think, the core structure of the book. But there's a moment of wild anxiety that was elicited by the project of the book, and this is his response to it, I think. I think the sublime is a fear that he was the person who wrote the third critique. Yeah?
So perhaps this is just a point of clarification where I'm missing something, but to say that Saw 3 inspires the same kind of feeling that looking at a teeming ocean does seems to... Well, you said earlier that the name of the safe place is reason, so there has to be a suspension of reason in some dramatic way in order for the sublime to actually occur. And it seems a stretch to say that a horror film is going to do that the way some kind of awe-inspiring moment in nature is going to do that.
Yeah, but what Saw 3, like 1 and 2, I only saw 1, and that was enough. I didn't go back for 2 and
6.
So, whoa! We're up to 6 or 8?
No.
But I take it the reason that the Saw thing has, as it were, carried on is that it's about our pleasure in sadistic defeat, right? That these are traps that exactly for people who think they can outsmart them. So it's a
It's a test of reason versus the threat, and that we both want to believe that reason can triumph, and we take both pleasure in the defeat and pleasure in the our distance from, like tragedy, ourselves, as it were, because at the end of the day, it's a trick. And at the end of the day, reason triumphs always in the soul, even if everyone dies, because you see through the trick. So we might go, oh, that was clever. I could, you know, if I think, you know. Because there's always an out. They just don't, you know, realize they have to bite off their leg or whatever to get out. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds just like a weekend at my home. Yeah.
The Kantian versus Hegelian other here, like, are you saying that they're overlapping here, or? But even if this is not nature, here nature is the other, not another subjectivity.
Yeah, I am suggesting, the reason I'm suggesting that sublime nature is also the other is because of the invitation. There has to be a desire to test my capacities, and from that test get confirmation. So somehow I am using, I'm screening, you know, that's why I said reason projects onto nature aesthetic ideas, so that it can focus as something
substance,
to be overcome.
Substance as subject.
Yes. So it's flip-flopping between those two. And I even know, yeah, the only letter he ever wrote agreement with me, Derrida said, oh, I guess you're right. That was a nice moment.
Yeah, just real quick, I'm still confused on this solid question. I hate to beat it to death. But it sounds to me, the way you're describing it, there's a structural similarity between things like the saw and the experience of the sublime. But are you claiming there's a structural similarity, or that there are actual instances of the sublime? Because it seems to me there's no overawing, either quantitative or dynamical aspect to the saw or the grapes that I'm reaching my hand into that are eyes.
Great. I am in the same way. It's great. It's structural similarity. Because I am, remember, thinking that there is a constant mutation from tragedy into horror. So things change at each moment, and we have to explain now why we go to saw rather than, as it were, test our things by going to you know, the waterfall, the rugged mountain. And I take it there'd be a site of cultural degeneration. This is just what my Sherman piece is about. So something, it's a analogous thing, but operates in a slightly different way. Must do.
Okay, but it couldn't be an instance because where does nature go? I mean, isn't it important?
Nature has so far disappeared. I understand horror movies to operate. Remember, my claim about the sublime was, even in the sublime, nature has almost disappeared. And we have to go out to seek it out in some weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
My claim in the modern world is, unless you go to central Maine, nature's gone. And that we don't even have that as a constant source of our self-understanding for this issue. And I take it that that's scary. That would be my cultural diagnosis. That even the question of nature, especially for us urban dwellers, has no longer plays a structural role in our understanding of ourselves as self-conscious beings. Now, arguably, Hegel thought by 1820, nature could no longer play that role. Right? So it's not like it was already, right, beginning to disappear. So the sublime seems to me a moment of at which the idea of nature will disappear until, right? Those of you who were at the conference this week will know Dipesh Chakrabarty's argument, until global warming will rearrange it as, again, putting us in nature. But arguably it disappeared for a couple hundred years.
if it doesn't the global warming thing, in the fascist thing, it can't be this humanistic reassurance, right?
Absolutely.
He refuses to invite us in global warming.
That's right. And he's saying it's the end of that kind of storytelling about our relationship to nature. That in it we return to the world emphatically as species only. And it's just part of nature. That was his argument.
Yep. Yeah, Mike?
I wonder if it's simpler than that, if this is kind of some if you could have non-purposive reason, it would be out of control reason, it would be unsympathetic reason. I mean, there are things we can reason that aren't in our favor, that are really scary because we're picking them out. If you have reason like that, couldn't the pleasure be simply that you endured something that you didn't feel ready for? So then you feel a certain pleasure because you've gone through the experience, but you didn't want to, and you just assume not. But then if you've got
it. I think...
But then it's just reason.
Yeah, my I guess the reason I'm skeptical about that is it's systematic role in our lives. That, you know, why this patterning through whole cultures of this notion of self-reassurance.
Well, because we normally use reason subsumed under purpose. I mean, that's what we're used to. So we could feel someone inadequate within that, in the sense that it's not adequate reason. It's just our reason, our sympathetic reason. So there could be some interest in actually exposing ourselves to a larger reason than...
I guess I don't think it's larger reason. I guess what's terrifying is if you're in the subway car with a drunk, not with someone who's demonic.
Well, it wouldn't be larger in the sense that you're trapped in context. If it's an unsympathetic reason, it sticks you in a context. It doesn't let you go off.
But it's still reason. Reason, I think, we find always, because reason is always another move.
I mean, you have to sort of rethink reason.
Well, that's what we're doing here, and I'm going to talk about art as another kind of reason. There's a lot of different kinds of reason, I think. But the idea of reason is always, there's another move. There's no other move here.
No. Well, wouldn't all of this be peachy keen if the objective were, like, contained in itself, like Hegel says? If objectivity were contained in consciousness, you know, the I and the other? Isn't like that how the continual like discrepancy would resolve itself?
Right now we don't have I guess what I want to suggest, which I'll do in the second half, we'll talk about art. Maybe you'll have to drag on to next week. But by the end of what I want to say about art, I think we have art because we do not have a world we can inhabit. So I don't see it as a question of philosophy tying up any ends here. I think you have to give an account that acknowledges the intransigencies.
No, but the thing is, for Hegel, it's not absolute subjectivity. You know, it makes itself become objective.
That's not the issue.
Okay, so what is?
The issue is the standing of reason with respect to the world that it has created. Just that. Yeah?
I'm wondering what's behind the claim that I think you're committed to, that nature can be repressed or consigned to the uppermost region of the New England states, but can't die.
My claim was
that claim because
no, my claim was it did. It has. That was the point of my response to Adam. That nature, that we no longer measure ourselves against that claim, at least not explicitly. Now, I agree that implicitly we do. Again, that's what I think art is about. That's what I think, which is why I think a lot of the art world is screwball, right? Because it thinks art is about something else. Protesting against whatever. And equally, I think it's what our fascination with sexuality is about, right? But I take it that we have such poor cultural account of these movements that we read them as something else, and I think something else we read them as is more like what Mike's talking about, namely, there's bad reason and we want to transgress it. And we don't understand the sources or the desires for our transgression. Maybe freedom. I mean, maybe freedom is what we think we're interested in. I suspect we do.
That's the account that I don't quite understand the claim about the indefinitely repetitive quality of testing rational self-conception. And so the account of the sublime that you've been setting up, because I think that the repetitive quality is fully predicated on its insufficiently compelling character.
Right. My argument there was Kant's argument. And I take it to the way in which we no longer feel compelled by that moment of the sublime in Kant is the way in which that repetition no longer operates. So the repetition was a hypothetical repetition of the 18th and 19th century sublime, not a projection into our future. That is, we think of it as structural. I don't think my hunch is, I could be wrong, it doesn't belong to us. That's a hunch.